Social networking sites have become a big place for people to play games. And where there are eyeballs, there are advertisers. Social games are the ones you play with your friends on sites like Facebook, and they're a hot new marketing target. But companies are not posting traditional banner ads. They're actually embedding the ads inside the games. As NPR's Shireen Meraji reports, you'll be seeing a lot more of them.
If you recognize that tune, you are one of the 97 million Facebook users who play Cityville. It's free to play. You start with an empty plot of land and build a city on it. You invite your Facebook friends to join in the fun and soon find yourself spending time collecting rent, building businesses, growing and harvesting crops.
I am not a player of social games, I have to say. I don't really have any extra time to plant virtual crops or race around Card Town.
That is unless you're busy analyzing the business of social games, which is what Paul Verna does for eMarketer. Verna says social game publishers take in most of their revenue from the sale of virtual goods. Gamers spend real money on virtual crops, fish food, you name it. And between last year and 2012, he adds, in-game ad revenue will more than double.
The types of companies that have advertised in social games run the gamut from fast food and premium packaged food, soft drinks, pet food, apparel, packaged goods, retail, financial services.
Alex Rampell, the CEO of TrialPay, says that list goes on and on because the social game world is so diverse. TrialPay matches advertisers with social game companies. There's Cityville, Farmville, Texas Hold'em Poker, Pet Society, Mafia Wars, Car Town. Rampell says basically anything you want to advertise will work with the theme of a social game that's out there.
Most people can't stand advertising. They want to skip it. Social gaming, by providing more crops or more fish or more virtual poker chips for the poker game, it actually encourages people to interact with advertisers, and they do take notice.
So I'm just going to show you what Farmville looks like by clicking on this button, and we will be transported magically to my farm.
I'm in Mark Zeitlin's office at the Farmers Insurance headquarters in Los Angeles. Farmers is the number three home and auto insurance company in the U.S. It's been around since 1928.
Right. Well, we've got what I would call a kick-ass farm. I've got a couple of fields full of crops right now.
Zeitlin is the vice president of e-business, a department that's about 2 years old. He never played Farmville before deciding it could be a great marketing tool for a very unhip insurance company. Now he's addicted.
And it is hard on a marriage and other relationships, but I was very happy to begin playing it because of the excitement around putting the farmer's airship into the game.
On the upper left of Zeitlin's computer screen is a cartoon version of a Zeppelin airship with the Farmers Insurance logo on it. He negotiated a deal with Zynga, the company that created Farmville, to make the virtual airship available in the game, free, for 10 days. And if you downloaded the Farmers Airship, you got a brief respite from virtual farming.
So we had one story from a grandmother, which I'm not quite sure if it's a happy or a sad story, but she felt really relieved that she had the airship protecting her crops from withering because she was able to spend more time with her grandchildren.
Zeitlin says over 5 million users, like that grandma, downloaded the airship. And in that time, the Farmers Insurance Facebook fan page went from a handful of fans to over 120,000. Real corporate money well spent in the virtual business world. Shireen Meraji, NPR News.
A new study suggests that it's surprisingly easy to get your hands on an endangered plant, and some activists are now going it alone trying to save rare species from extinction. But conservation experts worry there are potential risks when private groups start moving their favorite plants to new places. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports.
On your own, Terea taxifolia.
This is a chant that a woman named Connie Barlow wrote for a special day a couple years ago when she and some friends planted some tree seedlings, Terea taxifolia, also known as stinking cedar.
Welcome home.
The home in question was not Florida, where fewer than 1,000 of these endangered trees grow wild along one stretch of river, with their numbers dwindling. Instead, Barlow planted the trees on some private land in North Carolina, outside of its native range. Barlow is a writer and naturalist who says she felt an affinity to this ancient species.
I have a mystical side to me, where I spent time communing with the plant and try to get a sense of what it wanted.
She felt it wanted to leave Florida and migrate northward, where it might be more likely to survive climate change.
I said, I can do it for zero money, working with fellow volunteers, and we can legally give this plant a chance.
Her group was able to get their hands on privately owned plants and move them because federal laws treat endangered plants very differently than endangered animals. You can't say legally buy an endangered gray wolf and release it in your backyard, but plants are a different story.
It dates back to a very old tradition of how we treat species.
Patrick Shirey does conservation research at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. He also has a law degree.
Under common law, the person that owned the land owned the plants that were on the land, whereas the king owned the animals under English law.
He says, under federal law, endangered plants on your land are your property. You can give those plants to anyone as a gift. You can even sell them inside your state. And it is legal for someone to drive to a nursery, purchase an endangered plant, and then drive it out of state.
You could drive to South Carolina and bring a plant up to Maryland, and you would not be violating federal law.
It's not hard to find someone who wants to sell you a rare plant. Shirey and a colleague recently did a search on the internet looking for all 753 plants listed as threatened or endangered.
And searching phrases like seeds for sale and plants for sale.
They found that about 10% of these species were being advertised online, according to a report in the journal Nature.
There's been a lot of attention to the trade of endangered animals. There's been less attention to the trade of endangered plants.
Shirey says these plants deserve more attention because all this trade could create real ecological problems. Moving plants to different habitats could spread plant diseases. Or some plants could adapt to their new home too well and become invasive weeds. But with climate change looming as a possible new threat, some experts worry that concerned citizens will be more and more tempted to save a beloved species by transplanting it to someplace more hospitable. That worries Mark Schwartz. He's a plant ecologist at the University of California, Davis.
It takes a lot of thought and probably some science to understand the risks there. And volunteers generally aren't going through that assessment process. They're going out and doing things.
Still, Schwartz understands why they want to do something. He says far more money is spent on helping cute and fuzzy endangered animals than plants.
The Endangered Species Act is rather anemic with respect to accomplishing the job of protecting plants. It encourages people to take this job onto their own shoulders. And so there's a tension there.
He says private citizens can help native plants by pulling weeds or conserving their land. But when it comes to resettling a plant in a new area, Schwartz urges caution and says conservation groups need to come up with guidelines to help keep plant lovers from making big mistakes. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Bloch. President Obama paid a visit today to one of his most powerful enemies, the Chamber of Commerce. The chamber spent tens of millions of dollars against Democrats in last year's elections. It also opposed the president's policies on health care, energy, and financial rules. Now Mr. Obama wants to see if he can find common ground with the business lobby on this year's agenda of deficit cutting, tax reform, and trade. NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson reports.
The president traveled by foot today, walking across Lafayette Park to the Chamber of Commerce building, where he said he was just being neighborly.
Look, maybe if we had brought over a fruitcake when I first moved in, we would have gotten off to a better start. But I'm going to make up for it.
And he tried with a series of olive branches. He said he wanted to reform the corporate tax code and pass the Colombia and Panama trade agreements, although he didn't specify a timeline for those. He said he wanted to cut the deficit, including entitlements. He called for new investments in education, research, and infrastructure. And the president said this about one of the business lobby's biggest gripes, government regulation.
Already, we're dramatically cutting down on the paperwork that saddles businesses with huge administrative costs. We're improving the way FDA evaluates things like medical devices to get innovative and life-saving treatments to market faster. And the EPA, based on the need for further scientific analysis, delayed the greenhouse gas permitting rules for biomass.
It's unlikely he satisfied his audience with those gestures on regulation. The new chairman of the House Oversight Committee, Republican Daryl Issa, is leading an effort to roll back lots of regulations, with the EPA his biggest target. But the president also delivered a tougher message to the chamber. Echoing JFK, he said business has more to do.
Ultimately, winning the future is not just about what the government can do for you to succeed. It's also about what you can do to help America succeed.
There are huge banners hanging on the White House side of the chamber that spell J-O-B-S. And today the president tried to jawbone the business community into creating some of those jobs. Although he said this was not something we can legislate, he asked the chamber members to do what they could to close a widening chasm of wealth and opportunity in America.
If we're fighting to reform the tax code and increase exports to help you compete, the benefits can't just translate into greater profits and bonuses for those at the top. They have to be shared by American workers, who need to know that expanding trade and opening markets will lift their standards of living as well as your bottom line.
As Mr. Obama pointed out, American companies currently have nearly $2 trillion sitting on their balance sheets. And that's just one of the confounding things about the recovery. Corporate profits are at record highs, bonuses are up, so is the stock market, but hiring is not. I want to encourage you to get in the game, the president said.
And if there's a reason that you don't share my confidence, if there's a reason that you don't believe that this is the time to get off the sidelines, to hire and to invest, I want to know about it.
The president got a polite response, little applause, and a lot of stony silence. But Dave Adkinson, the president of the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce, stressed the business lobby's support for the president's investments in research and infrastructure.
The business community is calling for more investment in infrastructure. Our roads and bridges, you can't handle goods. I mean, in my own state, we have examples of that. It's spending on entitlement programs and doing business the way we've always done it in a lot of other areas that gets people concerned.
To push more money for infrastructure, the chamber has teamed up with the AFL-CIO, an unusual bipartisan pairing. And the chamber is even willing to go further than the president to pay for it. The chamber actually supports higher gasoline taxes, something White House Chief of Staff Bill Daley recently ruled out. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
People in the southern part of Missouri are proud of the movie Winter's Bone, even though it offers a grim portrait of their world. Set in the harsh landscape of the Ozarks, the film traces a young woman's journey as she searches for her father, who faces drug charges and has skipped bail.
Jessup signed over everything. Now, if he doesn't show at trial, see, the way the deal works is y'all gonna lose this place. Got some place to go?
I'll find him.
Girl, I've been looking.
I said I'll find him.
Winter's Bone was shot on a small budget using a mix of local talent and little-known actors. As Missy Shelton of member station KSMU reports, locals are thrilled that the film has been nominated for 4 Academy Awards, including Best Picture.
It's not often that people in the Ozarks have a special reason to celebrate at Oscar time.
I hope you heard the hillbilly screaming because it started early. And I think everybody's real excited about it. Real excited.
Beth Doman is one of the local actors in the film that's based on a novel by Missouri native Daniel Woodrell. Despite its dark story about the drug subculture here, Winter's Bone has been embraced by locals like Mike Dickerson and Leanne Drysdale. They attended a recent celebration of the movie's 4 nominations at a downtown restaurant in Springfield, Missouri.
I've seen it 5 times. Tonight's going to be my 6th. First time I saw it, I knew it was a winner. The whole cast is just marvelous.
I think you should start the Winter's Bone fan club.
I think I already have.
There was no red carpet surrounded by paparazzi, but local fans did have the chance to meet some of the actors, as well as the musicians featured in the film. Most of them live in the Ozarks, including Meredith Sisko, whose a cappella voice opens the movie.
Way down in Missouri, where I heard this melody, when I was just a little baby on my mama's knee, the old folks were humming, the banjos were strumming.
Because of the film's success, Sisko is trying to get used to requests for her autograph.
I'm Denny Pilot. I'm a fan. And I wonder if you could possibly sign my album.
I can. Let me, I don't know if I have the right
kind of pen.
Sisko's had to keep pens handy, whether she's traveling throughout the Ozarks, the U.S., or overseas.
Who would have thought? 67 years old, and I'm in a brand new career and going to Italy and Austin, Texas, and New York, and all that stuff. It's not anything at all I expected.
Almost everyone here who loves Winter's Bone talks about the authenticity of the film, from the accents to the scraggly-looking animals. Director Deborah Granick shot the film in Missouri so she could capture the details of Ozark's life. She recalls what happened when a shipment of brand-new Carhartt jackets arrived for the actors to wear.
We looked at these brand-new ones without any life, no history. No one had sweated or toiled. No one had stood in a deer stand for four godforsaken cold nights in any of these coats.
So the crew gave local residents the new Carhartt jackets in exchange for their worn ones. It's just these kinds of details that ring true for audiences here. Apparently, they've also won over some members of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Though locals are quick to acknowledge that Winter's Bone is a long shot for Best Picture, most say they're still thrilled that the film was nominated at all. For NPR News, I'm Missy Shelton in Springfield, Missouri.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. In his new book about euphemisms, Ralph Kies takes me back to browsing through a book on my parents' bookshelf about 50 years ago. It was a psychology text, probably written sometime before the Second World War, probably for some education course my father took, and it described the precise ranges of IQ that defined an idiot, a moron, and an imbecile. My father instructed me that those terms, and the broad category that included them all, the feeble-minded, were old ways of saying what we now said more properly. Such people were not to be called feeble-minded, idiotic, imbecilic, or moronic. They were to be called retarded, mentally retarded. It was only deep into adulthood that I realized, after using that word, that phrase, that it had become completely unacceptable. So it goes with euphemisms. One generation's version of polite and scientific is the next generation's standard for ham-fisted and defamatory. How and why this happens is the stuff of Ralph Kies's book, Euphemania, and the author joins us now from Yellow Springs, Ohio. Welcome.
Thank you.
And I want you to explain the point you make in this book, that many of the expressions which we avoid by using euphemisms instead were themselves introduced as euphemisms.
That happens all the time, Robert. Look at what's happening with hookup. I'm old enough to remember if I said 20, 25 years ago, I'm going to hook up with my wife in Grand Central Station, nobody would have batted an eyelash. If I said that today, I would be in deep doo-doo.
To use a euphemism. Our challenge here is to discuss things for which we use euphemisms precisely because we don't want to discuss them.
Exactly.
And a big part of what you're talking about in the book is bodily functions. Why are we so squeamish about bodily functions?
Well, there's been a lot of research that shows whatever disgusts us is a prime candidate for a euphemism, and so we come up with different words to refer to them. At one time, the word body wax was a euphemism for excrement.
Yeah, and as you write, there are a great many words that have a Latinate scientific air about them. Defecate is one. They sound authoritatively authentic, but as often as not, they were just dug up to replace some coarser words.
Exactly. Copulate is a Latinate word that simply meant at one time joined together. Then, of course, it became a euphemism for a certain kind of joining together, and now that's pretty much all it means.
At the end of Euphemania, your book, you turn to linguistics and evolutionary biology for a theory, which I find very interesting, of why blurting some words in moments of anger or fear or pain may be fundamentally different from expressing ourselves reasonably with language, and therein may lie the difference between some words that we use without thinking and then the way we think how not to use them.
Yes, it's well known that some people who suffer certain kinds of stroke lose their ability to speak, but they don't lose their ability to curse. And this has led linguistic researchers to conclude that swearing comes from a very primitive part of our brain and almost is not language at all. It's closer, say, to a dog's barking than to actual sophisticated conversation. So euphemisms, the ability to create indirect ways of referring to topics that make us uncomfortable, I think illustrates a fairly high order of intelligence and evolution. You know, when Shakespeare called the sex act making the beast with two backs, we had a very creative mind at work.
An area of language where it's less obvious to me why we should have so many euphemisms is eating and food. There's a great many euphemisms surrounding food.
Well, there certainly are. You think back to the word sweetbreads for the thymus glands. You know, who wants to eat thymus glands? But sweetbreads doesn't sound so bad. Rocky Mountain oysters for fried calves' testicles or lamb's testicles. But we don't even have to go that far back. The fish we today call Chilean sea bass and have for the last 30-some years originally was called the Patagonian toothfish. Not too appetizing. Orange ruffy is a euphemism for the fish that was originally called the slimehead.
But the Patagonian toothfish is the case of a name for a fish. And there's a man who renamed it a Chilean sea bass. That was actually a piece of marketing.
Yes, Lee Lance, a fish wholesaler in Los Angeles. And he just said, this is a good fish. Nobody wants to eat it. And let's just change the name. He came up with Chilean sea bass, and voila, it became so popular under the new name that now there's a movement to limit its catch and limit eating it in restaurants.
At one time, you remark, to mention, just to say legs, I guess this is in the Victorian era, to speak of legs, right there, this would be a remarkably rude thing to introduce into conversation.
Yes, legs were considered a very suggestive part of the anatomy. Women in Victorian times not only covered them up, but they thought that using the very word was suggestive, so you were not supposed to say leg, you said limb.
Extremities was also...
Extremities, is another word. And this then got carried over, going back to food, into poultry. You know, when you were invited to have dinner at someone's house, you knew better than to ask for a leg, you asked for a drumstick. When Winston Churchill, after World War I, was eating at a wealthy home in Virginia, the butler asked him what kind of chicken meat he'd like, and he said, some breast, please. Well, the woman next to him blanched and said, we don't use that word here. And Mr. Churchill said, well, what word do you use? She said, white meat. So the next day, he sent the woman a corsage with a card stuck in the middle that said, stick this on your white meat.
Ralph Kies, thank you very much for talking.
Thank you, Mr. Siegel.
Ralph Kies is the author of Euphemania, Our Love Affair with Euphemisms.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Having a midlife crisis? Forget the red Corvette. How about strapping on some cross-country skis and going a very long way in them? We'll find out more about this intriguing story in just a few minutes. But first, we want to talk about food, a looming crisis in food. The United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization said last week that world food prices hit a record high in January, driven by huge increases in the prices of wheat, corn, sugar, and oils. And prices are expected to keep rising in the coming months. That's bad news for consumers and governments. Surging prices in 2007 and 2008 led to protests and unrest in scores of countries. And last month, Algerians rioted again over the cost of flour and sugar, which had doubled in recent months. Here in the U.S., after a stretch of relative stability in food prices, economists say shoppers should expect to see a 4% rise in costs at the supermarket checkout this year. So what's behind this latest global food crisis and what's being done about it? To find out, we've called Abdelreza Albassian. He's a senior economist with the Food and Agricultural Organization, the FAO, and he's with us from the organization's headquarters in Rome. Also with us here in our Washington, D.C. studio, NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Giwex. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Hello.
Thank you for the invitation.
Mr. Abbasian, I'll start with you. What exactly has contributed to the sharp rise in food prices?
Well, the most important factor was weather developments in 2010. We had unfavorable weather during critical growing period or at harvest, like the drought in Russia, the rains in U.S., in North Europe. We had, as you know, the rains and floods in Australia. So whether reduced yields or cut production here and there, and all of this happened while demand continued to increase. So the net result, you know, in any market is when you have demand rising and supply not keeping pace is for prices to rise.
Is it accurate, though, that in some parts of the world, in places like Egypt and in Ethiopia, that people spend as much as half their income on food? Is that still accurate?
Even more so. The less, I would say, affluent you are as a country or as a people, the more of your income is spent basically on the very basic of the food. So it could be as high as sometimes 70%. And this is where really the big concern is, because globally, food prices have gone up almost at least on average about 50-60%, you know, year to year. So fortunately, not nationally, this hasn't happened to that level in most places, but you could imagine the if it does, or what sort of implication it would have for the poorest of the poor.
Marilyn, we haven't been feeling the pinch nearly as severely in this country as other nations have. As I understand it, the USDA issued a report last year that showed that grocery prices rose by less than 1% last year. That's compared to about 100% in some countries. Why is that?
There's such a disconnect between what happens to U.S. consumers and the rest of the world, but it's because so little of our groceries actually have food in them. Now, think about this. If you go into a grocery store and you buy a box of cornflakes for $4, the price of the corn that's in there is very small. It might just be pennies, 6 cents, 7 cents. What you're really paying for there is the transportation cost, the advertising for a Tony the Tiger, the cost of a unionized cashier to check you out. So if you had 6 cents worth of corn in a box of cornflakes, and let's say the price doubled, well, now it's 12 cents. So when you get to the cash register, maybe instead of paying $4 for a box, you pay $4.06. It's just not that big of a deal for us, relatively.
We're talking about the soaring price of food around the world. Here in our Washington, D.C. studio, we have NPR senior business editor Marilyn Geewax. Also with us, Abdulreza Abbasian. He's a senior economist with the U.N.'s Food and Agricultural Organization. Marilyn, economists, as we said, are predicting a 4% increase in grocery prices this year. Is that likely to register in the United States? Is that likely to get the consumers' and the policymakers' attention here in this country?
Even though we have relatively less food inflation than other countries, poorer places where, you know, as I say, the rice in a box of Rice Krispies is small, but if you just buy a sack of rice in a poor country, you know, you really feel the increase. However, having said that, there is a lot of inflation in the pipeline because of the rising oil prices, these growing prices for crops. It will start to filter through. And for people in the United States who are on a fixed income, let's say you're on Social Security and you haven't gotten a raise, well, if food prices go up 3 or 4%, even though that's not as much as what somebody might feel in Yemen, it's still, you know, it's going to squeeze your budget. We're really going to start to feel it.
Mr. Abbasian, I use the word crisis in my introductory remarks. Do you think that that's the right word?
I think that we are certainly experiencing a price shock in terms of agricultural raw materials. As far as a crisis in terms of food crisis, right now our view is that no, this is not so far. Now, one of the good things we've had this year is that, in fact, rice prices are below last year and they're about 50% below the level in 2007 and 2008. So that already gives you some comforting views about, at least in countries where rice is very important as a food, such as in Asia. Take corn, for example. In Africa, a lot of Africans eat white corn, white maize. Now, harvests in those countries in 2010, nearly in all parts of sub-Saharan Africa, had been above average to record, which meant that they didn't have to actually buy corn from world market at those punitive levels. And this also helped those countries. Having said that, we are concerned because the world prices are not coming down and there is very little likelihood to expect them to do so until big harvest. And the longer this takes, the more the chance of transmission and the spillover effect to other commodities and to countries, even the poorer ones. And for them, it's not a question of buying less, it's cutting out a meal. And that's very dangerous.
Marilyn?
You know, there's one thing that's a little interesting in all of this is so far, while these rising food prices have been devastating to a lot of poor people in other parts of the world. In the United States, so far, a lot of the impact has actually been sort of good for our economy. That is, the rural economy has done really well. Corn prices are way up. Wheat is way up. You look at unemployment numbers in the Dakotas and Nebraska. That's the part of the economy that's actually doing very well. So far, we have benefited when there's a drought in Russia and they can't produce any wheat and our farmers can. What we're seeing is a lot of growth in the rural economy, and in fact, pickup truck sales have been up in the United States, largely because people in rural areas are going out and buying new equipment. So it's sort of ironic, but really, this global food crisis has so far been sort of a plus for the U.S. economy.
Well, let me ask you this, though, Marilyn. A number of advocates in the United States are saying that food insecurity, which is a term that they prefer now instead of hunger, that food insecurity, particularly among children, has increased dramatically over the course of the recession. Now, why is that?
It's just really tied to this jobs problem that we have in this country. There are just people who used to have paychecks and now they don't. And they've really had a hard time making up, keeping enough food in the house for their families. If you don't have that steady paycheck and your unemployment benefits are running out, your household can very easily slip into a situation where you're actually hungry.
And finally, Mr. Abbasian, the World Economic Forum in Davos met recently. Was food discussed there? And what do the leading industrialized nations suggest as a solution? Or is it on their agenda?
Well, more so is in the G20 agenda, and very much central, I would say, when President Sarkozy was visiting Washington, meeting President Obama. The core discussion actually focused on food security. And I think it's very much captured the central stage far more than in the past, even more than L'Aquila before. So it is certainly a very important issue, not just because prices are so high, but also because they are very volatile. And it seems often that markets may not be functioning well, at least that's the view of some people. So there are a lot of attention into looking into this in detail to come with some solutions.
And that, finally, Marilyn, final thought from you?
Yeah, there's still there's a lot of question, too, about markets, whether or not there's too much speculation. There are a lot of people in the world who are angry about people buying up corn and wheat for financial gain instead of to feed people. So that's a controversy that's out there. And also concerns that interest rates have been held so low for so long that people who are looking for higher returns on their investments are turning to buying things like corn and wheat and instead of stocks and bonds. And that's caused, some anger out there about financial markets.
And what happens to that food? Does it just get stockpiled?
Well, it does get eaten. It's just that it's at higher prices. If people are, just as we've seen the price of gold go up, all kinds of commodities have increased. And there's this concern that there's too much liquidity, as they call it, too much money. And people are buying real assets, farmland and crops. And that tends to drive up prices.
That's NPR senior business editor Marilyn Giewak. She was here with us in our Washington, D.C. studio. With us from Rome, Amduresa Abbasian, a senior economist with the Food and Agricultural Organization. He was with us from his organization's headquarters there in Rome. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. You're welcome.